Welcome to Media Watch. We're very delighted this week to have Robert Federici, who is a reporter for ProPublica. He covers politics and money, obviously a really big and important topic. Before that, he's also worked for the Los Angeles Times and did a very interesting story for his college newspaper that we might get to ask him some questions about. I'm Laura Leff, and with me is Josh Brown, and we'll be asking questions, and we'll start with Josh.
Yeah, thank you for being here, Robert. First question, you're a lot different than a lot of the people we've had in terms of the outlet you work for. A lot of Politico, you know, people who kind of write just more kind of general news. What is like a ProPublica story?
So ProPublica is an investigative journalism nonprofit. So our coverage is different in that we mostly do sort of medium and long-term, and actually increasingly sort of short-term investigative pieces. So we almost never go to like press conferences or cover, you know, an occurrence of the day or anything like that. And then the business model is different in that we don't really, I mean, hardly any of our revenue comes from ads. We mainly get donations from individuals and foundations. So that frees us up a bit to maybe work on stories that other outlets aren't working on, or, you know, tackle topics that might take a lot of resources, you know, and time that other outlets might not be able to afford to be able to handle. So, you know, it's different as far as coverage, and it's different as far as the business model goes.
Your website says you do for the public need, I think, or the public interest.
Yeah.
So what does that look like? Just a couple of examples for the people who aren't too familiar. Obviously, again, like I said, different than like your standard Politico or New York Times story.
Well, I mean, I would argue that the New York Times is doing public service too, and Politico is as well. There's a bigger emphasis at our shop on picking stories that could have potential impact. Obviously, you know, as reporters, we're not trying to dictate what that impact is. I mean, that's when you start to sort of enter the advocacy realm. But, you know, we try to pick stories that could change things, that could address things that are obviously going wrong. And so that's different. But again, I mean, you know, I did a big project on, you know, the lobbying around fire safety in homes, and the central component was about, you know, a requirement on fire sprinklers that, you know, saves lives, but the home builder lobby was fighting tooth and nail against, and it's, you know, it's months on fire sprinklers, and that's, you know, it's important, but it sounds really boring, and, you know, it might not happen at another outlet. So
what would you, I mean, how do you define impact? I mean, I know the site follows up and sort of says somebody resigned as if this, I mean, is what would be a story, I mean, what's the kind of impact you're looking for? Because investigative is a pretty broad category. It could be anything.
Yeah, I mean, so the most obvious kind of impact is if someone gets indicted or someone resigns, right? But it can get a lot more subtle than that, you know, like a bill being introduced, you know, a bill being passed, you know, policies changing within an agency. And then, you know, we even sort of count, you know, for example, if public opinion is changed or the dialogue around something shifts, that's also impact. So it can sort of span, you know, a range of...
Did something happen from the fire sprinkler story?
Let me think. Did anything happen from the fire sprinkler story? No, I don't think there's any impact on that one.
Was it weird, like, adjusting for you that, like, you're kind of measuring, not totally, but in, like, a little bit, measuring success on, like, people getting fired or laws changing? Was that kind of, like, a weird thing to kind of celebrate that?
I mean, I wouldn't say, like, we're trying to get people fired. Again, we're not trying to sort of specify what the, you know, we're not saying we want X impact or Y impact, but it's just, it's good to see stories resonate and action to come as a result of them. But in general, I mean, I think any reporter who told you that it wasn't satisfying to see, you know, actions taken as a result of their work would be lying. I mean, it's a professionally satisfying experience when it happens. Generally, right? Sometimes there's impact that you don't foresee, and it can be negative impact. I don't know. It's a complicated question, but we're not trying to get anyone fired or anything like that. It's not we're just trying to expose things that should be exposed, and whatever happens, happens.
Who like if you had to nail down your primary audience, who would it be?
I mean, I think that changes based on the story. I mean, like, typically, you know, some stories will focus very narrowly at a particular niche, you know. Others will be trying to get as wide of an, you know, audience as possible. The interesting thing about ProPublica is, you know, after we do stories, sometimes we'll have public forums, in the place that's affected or with the community that's affected. So we'll really spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, who is the story targeted towards, you know, who are the sort of decision makers in this realm, and we'll do our best to sort of get it in front of them.
Can you give an example of that on maybe a story that you
We've been doing a lot of stories on these deregulation task forces that President Trump has created in all the, you know, most of the significant federal agencies, and in the process to get more sources on that, because it's been iterative. We've been doing stories, and we're going to be continuing to do stories. One thing that we did is that, we created a call out for people who worked in government and may have had information on those task forces, and we used Facebook's, you know, targeted ads to sort of get at people who work at the Department of Justice, or get at people who work at...
Oh, so you actually reached out as opposed to just...
So it was sort of an active effort to cultivate sources who work for the federal government, which I had never done anything like that. I think at ProPublica maybe we had done something like that once before, I see that as just a more proactive way of sourcing, and, you know, reporters do that on sort of a micro level all the time, and this was doing it, you know, on a big macro blast level. And
so
I think
that's really
great.
Interesting. Can you say a little bit more about sort of how you found those people to target, and then what kind of...
So that's our engagement team that knows all the nitty-gritty, but, I mean, you know, Facebook lets you target all sorts of tiny demographics. So,
so this is a good use.
As far as we're concerned, yeah.
And there were no problems with doing that in terms of privacy, or?
No, I mean, you know, Facebook is selling advertisers, you know, the ability to do targeted ads all the time. No, I don't think so.
And what kind of response did you get?
So we had plenty of people who work in government reach out. In a couple cases, we had people who were on, you know, on the private sector side of this reach out. You know, there are people within these agencies who want to talk to us and who are interested in helping us, you know, put out the most accurate reporting possible. So, you know, it's been helpful.
And how many responses have you had about
this? Probably a couple dozen, you know, people who are actually relevant. I mean, we get plenty of people just writing in and saying stuff, you know, but people who are relevant to the process, probably a couple dozen.
You mentioned it there, but it looked like you were reaching out to the public, too, just like in general. We looked at the page you put up looking for people who were in the regulation task force. It looked like just looking for the general public, too. Do you get, like, a lot of tips from, like, just normal, everyday people, or?
So we certainly welcome folks in the general public engaging, but often that kind of engagement doesn't result in story leads. It's sort of like, why wouldn't you want an industry person, you know, helping to deregulate? They're an expert. Or on the other side, you know, these people are trying to poison us all. You know, this is awful. You know, just more sort of like opinionated type of emails. And, I mean, you know, you appreciate the engagement with your work, but it doesn't necessarily lead to particular stories.
So that when you actually got the names of people who were on these regulatory task force and hadn't been disclosed, that came from people within the agency?
It's mostly come from our public records requests, but we have gotten some useful guidance from people who have reached out.
How many do you think you guys have nailed down? Like, how many do you think, I know, like, there's not, like, a specified number, but how many do you think there are on these regulation teams, and how many do you think you haven't found yet?
So the breakdown is on our webpage. There are a couple agencies where we have, there's one agency where we have none. There are several agencies where we only have one. And then there are other agencies where we believe we have a full list now, but we aren't sure because the agencies won't tell us if it's a full list. So it's kind of a guessing game as to what percentage we have. We don't know. Even for the agencies where we have 8-10 names, we don't know if
to
we have.
To back up a little bit, could you talk about how you decided to do that project? And I know you teamed up on that project with the New York Times, so that would also be a kind of interesting process. But you know, where did the idea come from, and then how did you decide to go about tackling it?
Right. So, I mean, the idea came from, you know, President Trump signed the executive order, you know, telling these agencies to all form these task forces. And I mean, as you know, I'm always sort of on the hunt for story ideas, and I figured, you know, this would be sort of a manageable universe. You know, it's going to be one team in every agency. You know, they have sort of a narrow agenda, which is to find regulations that are overly burdensome and either roll them back partially or eliminate them altogether. So I figured it was sort of ripe for the types of projects we do. It was important, but not sort of unwieldy. So I figured that the tough part would be figuring out, you know, what their conflicts are and what they're up to. But, you know, like I was saying, even figuring out their identities was incredibly difficult. The agencies either weren't responding to us or were giving us the runaround with, you know, responses to our public records requests that would redact the names of appointees to a public task force, which I had never seen before. In one case, they used an exemption that's typically used for, you know, sensitive law enforcement personnel. And again, this was, you know, a public task force at the VA. You know, didn't seem to qualify. And then as far as the collaboration goes, I mean, we're always sort of talking to other newsrooms. And I think the way it happened was Danielle Ivory at the New York Times had mentioned to someone at our shop that she was interested in these task forces and, you know, and had been sort of poking around. And I, you know, someone said, oh, you know, Robert's already been looking at this. You guys should work together. And so obviously then you have to go through the, you know, bureaucratic sort of dealings of, you know, figuring out what the terms of the collaboration are and sort of figuring out how you're going to share and whether you're going to do stories together or just share data and all of that. But eventually, you know, we did a full-on collaboration. That's been
now, when you said that you had never, I mean, when you started this, did you think you would just be able to go to the VA or go to the Department of Agriculture and say, who's on your task force? And then the tough part would be trying to figure out what, if any conflicts there existed. Were you surprised that you couldn't even get the name of the...
Yeah. I thought getting the names would be like a half day's work or one day's work, you know, just emailing a public information officer and saying, who's on your task force? I can say I was shocked that that wasn't the case. I mean, it continues to be just sort of pulling teeth to figure out who these people are. And when we do figure out who they are, it becomes pulling teeth to get the agency to confirm on the record that these people are.
What do you think that's about? I mean, why is there such a reluctance to? And it sounds like you're saying, and you can, you know, tell me if this is not correct, that this is somewhat unusual to this administration, the reluctance to at least describe who is on a task force.
Yeah, I mean, so it's tough to do, you know, like a apples to apples quantitative comparison of this administration's transparency to the last administration. I mean, the last administration, you know, FOIAs were hellish. There were plenty of problems. You know, the idea that they were, you know, so transparent is inaccurate. But this level of secrecy where you couldn't even figure out, you know, government officials, you know, do, on a public task force, who they were, that struck me. Why it's been this way, I'm not sure. I can say in my personal experience that there have been many cases now of public information officers, you know, people who we pay with our taxpayers to give us public information, being particularly difficult to deal with, particularly combative, particularly non-responsive. Maybe I'm just having bad luck. I don't know. I don't know if I can say that it's an administration-wide thing. But it had, you know, there has been an unusual amount of hostility, in my experience.
You get which departments are kind of easier to deal with then?
I may just be individuals within departments, so I don't want to sort of cast a wide net on an entire department, you know. But there have been issues in several departments.
And what does that look like? And so if you're getting hostility and maybe even obstruction, can you give an example of that? Maybe not without using the name of the agency, but just to give us a better feel for, as a reporter, what it means to encounter that kind of hostility.
Yeah, so sometimes it can just be very sort of vulgar conversations where, you know, you're being sworn at and yelled at on the phone for asking basic questions. Other times it can be being accused of being dishonest or manipulative or something to that effect when, you know, you've been, at least in your own opinion, totally transparent and upfront about what you're doing.
And these are public information.
Yeah, yeah. In one case, and I won't go into the details of which agency because we're still working on this, but I had an exchange with a public information officer, you know. And the point of that exchange was to figure out, you know, I had some records and I was trying to figure out the significance of these records. I was trying to figure out whether they were an ethics violation or not, what they showed. Eventually, you know, I get an email back and the public information officer has sent all of my questions, which basically lay out everything I know, and all of the records I got through FOIA. To every reporter who has ever covered that agency, with, you know, sort of a lengthy email calling me fake news and, you know, all sorts of other things, which was just...
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was... I had never seen that before.
Where is that coming from? I mean, are these people who are experienced? I mean, I assume this is... These are not the people who are doing it in the same positions for the Obama administration or the Bush administration.
No, no. So these will typically be people who, they may have worked in government before, but typically these will be people who came in with the new administration. And again, I'm not trying to give anyone the notion that it's totally unusual to be combative with, you know, public information officers. Every agency I've ever covered, you know, sometimes they're really helpful, sometimes they're not totally honest or not totally nice, and that's part of the job. I just, you know, it may be a bit more common now covering this administration. That's the only point I'm trying to make.
When you put out like a FOIA and you get that response, like how do you, with your reporting, how do you move on from there? How do you keep kind of pursuing whatever you're trying to look into, and how do you kind of move on when you're not getting help from?
Well, so, I mean, if you're only talking to public information officers, you're not doing your job right. You know, they shouldn't be your only sources. They shouldn't be the only people you're talking to. You should be talking to the people who are also, you know, involved in the actual work of governance. So, you know, you just continue talking to the people you talk to, and, you know, I try to sort of stay totally calm and not make it personal, and you know, maintain my politeness, and you know, like I don't get sucked into that as best as I can. At
so
least.
You said you're still working with the agency that gave away all your sources and all of your information to every other reporter.
Well, didn't give away my sources.
Not that's, the sources,
yeah,
just so,
but gave away all my material.
Your material. What happened? Did other people write about it?
Luckily not. No.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so and I don't know if it was because, you know, they couldn't really figure out what it was, or if they just decided that it wouldn't be a cool thing to do. But no one else has written about it
and
yet.
And you're still working on that story.
Yeah, yeah.
Going back to the regulatory task force real quick, I think I was reading the comments on some of the articles that you wrote about it, and a couple of people said they kind of wanted to know why it was such a big deal. terms of them being kind of advisory only, not really having any executive, or obviously not having any executive power, but not really, you know, just being advisory in nature. Do you want to just maybe shed some light on why it's such an important story, who is on the task force?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, obviously regulations are really important. You know, when they're overly burdensome, they can cost consumers and businesses a ton. You know, they can kill jobs. That's certainly true. When they're doing what they're supposed to, they can, you know, protect the health of the public. They can keep roads safe. They can, you know, they affect the financial markets. They affect everything. So it's an area of governance that really affects people and businesses. Aside from that, I mean, these are people who are handpicked by the heads of agencies to, you know, tell them which regulations to roll back or eliminate. And then they report back to the agency heads, and that gets the process started. So they, you know, have high-level access to the person who's going to be making, you know, going to be initiating these changes.
A lot of them, like you guys wrote about, kind of maybe have conflict of interest, you know, working in a, or for, you know, lobbied for someone and now is kind of involved in that whatever specific department or regulation or whatever. But you guys did only find, I think it was two, who stands to financially make money off of whatever they're arguing to roll back in terms of regulation. You know, it is, you guys have written quite a few stories about that. Is it really a big problem if only two people, you know, have kind of a conflict of interest in which they would make money? Is it, just how big of a problem is it?
So there are two people who have been on these teams who could potentially stand to personally profit. But then there are, I'm forgetting the exact number, but dozens, I think low dozens, who have worked for employers who have, you know, been regulated by these agencies or who have tried to, you know, change regulations at these agencies. So they come from a private sector employer who has a stake in what happens at the agencies they're now at. So that doesn't necessarily mean that they would personally profit, but it means they come in with a frame of reference on these things that could be potentially benefiting one employer instead of the public at large. The counter argument to all of that is that no one understands regulations better than the people who are regulated. So they certainly come in with a lot of expertise too. But the question is whether they're going to be taking actions that benefit a particular part of the industry or a particular business. That's why we think it's important to vet their backgrounds and put this out there so everyone is aware of what their potential conflicts are.
On that line, I read there was a new bill that would require the federal officials to disclose the conflict of interest with people on these task forces and different committees and everything. What's kind of, is that making any progress? Do you think it'll pass? What are the odds that kind of gets through?
Zero. Close to zero. Last I checked, it doesn't have any Republican support. You know, the president would need to sign it. One of the things it would do is require the president to disclose specifically how much he would profit from every significant regulatory change. I just don't envision any president. I don't envision really any president signing that, especially when it's initiated by the other party, or it even gaining the support of the other party enough to pass. It could. It's obviously possible, but the way Washington, you know, the major, both chambers are have majority Republicans. This was a Democrat initiated bill. I don't see it passing.
I think the counter argument to releasing the names like you guys are doing is that if people know who they are, they're going to get more, you know, lobbyists hitting or contacting them, trying to influence them if their name's in the public. Does that kind of come into consideration at all? If you guys are revealing them, then they're actually might be open to more kind of, I don't want to say corruption, but more influence than if they had remained kind of in the shadow?
That's actually an argument that was made by the head of the task force at the USDA. She, after our stories, there have been meetings on the Hill where, congressional aides from the Oversight Committee will meet with representatives from these task forces. And in her meeting, you know, they said, hey, give us the rest of these names, at least according to sources we have, this is what happened. And she said, no, if I tell you the names, you know, we're going to be deluged with lobbyists. And what we found is that she was actually already meeting with lobbyists, and specifically lobbyists that she used to work with or that used to be, clients of the pesticide trade group that she lobbied for.
Did you just do a real quick summary of the story?
Sure. So the head of the task force at USDA, her name is Rebecca Adcock, and immediately prior to joining the USDA in the Trump administration, she was a top lobbyist for the trade group CropLife, which represents, you know, Syngenta and Monsanto and all these chemical companies. And she had agreed upon getting the job that she wasn't going to work on any issues that she had previously lobbied on, and that she wasn't going to consider issues that would specifically affect CropLife or any of its clients. So she signs that agreement, and we found that weeks later she had meetings with CropLife, with members of CropLife, that she had discussed the effect of pesticides on water, on the safety of water, which was one of the things that she had, you know, pledged not to work on. So it's a potential violation. The USDA is saying it's not a violation of her ethics agreement. An ethics expert that we presented it to believed it may have been.
Found out about those meetings from visitors' logs?
Yeah, so we've been trying to, just get calendars of meetings for her and other people on the task force, which is usually a pretty basic, straightforward FOIA. Some public officials will even post their calendars on websites. It's not some secret document, or at least it shouldn't be, but we've had a ton of trouble even getting calendars. So one sort of creative workaround that we thought up was to ask for sort of like the security sign-in sheets, like when you enter a building, sometimes you have to say time in and sign it and say who you're visiting. And those are a lot easier to get. So we have asked for those from all the agencies.
Did you have to FOIA those or were those?
We had to FOIA those, but I think because they're just such basic documents and they come from the security office or something, they've been coming in a lot quicker. But what that means is that, we have to look through every visitor who has come in for any reason, for anyone. So it means going through, like, thousands and thousands of pages. And it's usually, a security guard who may write in cursive and then you can't read it, or may just have terrible penmanship. It was a creative workaround for us, but it's been sort of hellish to go through those. We've gone through all.
You personally.
Me and my reporting partner, Danielle.
You don't have interest in that?
If anyone is interested, seriously. So the other problem is you don't capture, if they come in and they sign the secretary's name instead of the person, whoever they're actually going to meet with, then you don't capture that. Or if it's a phone conversation, you don't capture that. Or if it's off-site, you don't capture that. So it's pretty imperfect, but it's the best we have now. So that's how we found those meetings. I forget where I was going with that one. What was your initial question?
So long ago.
So what we found is that they're already meeting with lobbyists. To be honest, the notion that a lobbyist in that world wouldn't be able to figure out who's on this task force, it's not very realistic.
Have they done anything yet? I mean, they're meeting, but have they actually produced?
So they've begun identifying rules that they are considering for rollback. I mean, the process of getting rid of a regulation, you actually have to write a new regulation to get rid of an old regulation. It can take years. There can be legal challenges. So what's happening right now is actually really important, because all of these industries want to kind of get to the front of the line so that they can complete this process while they still have a more business-friendly administration in place. So getting before these task forces now is really important.
If you have to write one for everyone you eliminate, Trump said he wants to eliminate two for everyone they add. How would he go about doing that?
So it's not actually, it's more like the cost. So it doesn't have to literally be get rid of two for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's a more nuanced sort of analysis that they have to do.
One question, and I'm trying to phrase this in a way that, not mean, but this seems sort of quaint, right? I mean, in a good way, but the idea that what's needed here is to show, okay, this person who's at head of this advisory task force that's charged with getting rid of regulations, work for lobbyists, and if we just all know that, then something will happen. But there have been so many ways in which there have been fairly obviously, and even much bigger conflicts that people just kind of shrug off. I mean, how do you see what you're doing as contributing to the, I mean, is it just you go through the motions, or do you really see revealing this as mattering?
I think it matters. I mean, I think, I don't know if this is the best sort of the most relevant story, but I, you know, my first staff job was at the Sacramento Bee, and there was a new university that had popped up in the UC system, the University of California system. It was in this little agricultural town called Merced. So I think I was going there, I can't remember if it was at the end of their first school year or at the end of their fourth school year, like their first graduating class. I think it was probably the first. And anyway, so I was like, you know, I was just trying to gather color as a feature story. And I went to like the student government meeting, and it's just like, you know, six or eight people in student government, and in a little room, you know, there's no audience. They're, you know, in a room much smaller than this. And there was one, you know, college student like sitting in the corner who wasn't at the table. So I went up to him. I figured he was part of the, you know, student paper on campus. So afterwards, I went to go talk to him and maybe get some more color about what it's like to work the student paper. And he was like, no, I don't work at the student paper. I just come to make sure that they know they're being watched. which, like, when I was in college, but I think that's important, right? For people in power, even on the scale of a student government, to know they're being watched and to know that someone's paying attention. I think that's good for democracy, and certainly on this level, right? You know, putting it out there when there are potential conflicts of interest, exposing instances where ethics agreements are potentially violated. I don't know exactly what effect it's having, but I think that an absence of that kind of reporting would be dangerous, no matter which party was in power, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, it's important for us to be doing this work.
Just to push that on, so you did this story about a mining company executive who had all of these serious violations when he was either running them, covering your significant positions, and he gets confirmed. So how does that make you feel? I mean, even just aside from the...
Totally great. I can honestly say I am never writing a story and hoping X thing happens or Y thing happens. It was important to me to get the story out before his confirmation hearing, right? Because it's important to get out any relevant, right? To get out any relevant information. But after that, I feel like my job is done. I mean, I think you sort of venture into activist realm when you're hoping someone you're covering doesn't get confirmed, or you're hoping someone you're covering gets fired, or what's important to me is getting out important stories, exposing things that should be exposed, and just you know, whatever happens after that happens.
So, for example, I mean, you wrote all that on Tom Price, and then he kind of did him in with the private plane usage. That doesn't bother you at all, that, like, it wasn't, you're kind of reporting with something totally different?
Well, that's, I mean, that's a little bit different, right? Because I think those stories were really important.
Can you just quickly summarize?
Yeah. So I had done a bunch of stories about Tom Price, who was Trump's HHS secretary, but before that was a congressman, sort of mixing his financial interests and his donors' financial interests with actions he was taking as a congressman. And, you know, others had done great work in that realm, too. Considering the fact that that didn't affect him, I was a bit surprised that the private flights did. But again, that was hugely important work, and, you know, Politico did an incredible job on that. I mean, they were doing stakeouts at airports and just, like, totally awesome work. I guess... The only way it bugs you is, like, you just sort of kick yourself for, you were doing Tom Price coverage, and, like, you should have thought of the idea of looking at his expenditures and, you know, his flights and all that. So you kick yourself in the sense of, that was a great story and you wish you did it. But you don't kick yourself in the sense of, oh, someone else's work forced him to resign. I wish my work would have forced him to resign. I mean, you shouldn't think that way. But, yeah, I was totally kicking myself for not finding that story instead of Politico, but, you know, that's just because Politico found an amazing story, and, you know, I was jealous.
Although there might have been, I mean, if you were going to, I mean, they're both important stories, but one was just kind of run-of-the-mill, I mean, well, not run-of-the-mill, because the amounts were fairly large, but, you know, just sort of a little abusing your position by spending too much money, as opposed to what you revealed, which was a real conflict, right? Which was someone who, at least potentially, was putting in legislation that would benefit either himself directly or his donors directly, which seems to be more serious than chartering a flight from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia, right? So, I mean, I mean, do you have some sense why one was more, ended up being what got him rather than the other?
I mean, what was reported, the palace intrigue of it was sort of that he was already kind of, he wasn't really well-loved within the administration. He hadn't been helping out enough with the repeal effort. So he'd sort of fallen into disfavor, and, you know, this was an excuse to get rid of him. Another sort of thing people speculated was that, you know, Trump had sort of campaigned on this idea of, you know, draining the swamp and getting rid of sort of wasteful government spending and that kind of thing, and this was wasteful government spending, and it sort of really hurt the message that he was pushing. It could have been either. I don't know why. You never really know.
So it wasn't because your stories weren't more important.
I think both are important.
Kind of similarly, you guys put out, I mean, we talked about four major issues that you've reported on, and then you're just one reporter at ProPublica, one of, I think, 35. Do you think the fact that you guys put out so much on a variety of issues maybe doesn't hurt the cause, because, like you said, you're not activists, but kind of makes people tune out? There's so much going on that people kind of can't keep track of Tom Price, private planes, and Russia, and, like, a million different issues going on?
I think it's definitely, I don't think it's a function of, you know, ProPublica is putting so much out so it gets drowned out. I think everyone is putting so much out that, I mean, it's like there are two sides to the coin. On one side, I feel like there has been so much amazing journalism in the last year, and it's a really exciting time to be an investigative reporter, or to even be a beat reporter, covering your beat well. And part of that is because there's so much public interest in your work. So, you know, stories on, stories on regulations that, you know, typically are important but don't get a lot of public interest are now getting a ton of public interest, and that's exciting. On the other end, you know, like an incredible story will come out, and people will be sort of obsessed with it for 3 hours, and then another incredible story will come out, and then another and another and another, and it's only been 2 days, but everyone's totally forgotten about the first one. It's you know, it does get drowned out. It's been the newsiest year in I don't know how long. And, you know, in some ways sort of like a golden age of journalism, right? But in other ways, you know, like any one of these stories that we've mentioned today or that, you know, we've seen even this week could have been a month-long story in a news cycle from 4 years ago.
What difference does it make if it's not a month-long story, right? I mean, so what's the... And I actually think this may have something to do with the impact, right? Because, like, part of it is something breaks and then it builds and more people condemn and then you kind of can go through the cycle where it has an impact. But if it's confined to 1 or 2 days, then it dissipates. Do you think that it's limiting the impact of any of these stories, or...?
I never really thought about that, but yeah, I could certainly see that, right? If stories are immediately getting drowned out by other stories,
I'm even thinking that at the same time you had the stories about Price, you had similar kinds of stories about other members of the Trump administration, who Zinke and Shulkin at VA, and they're still there. Now, it may be because they're more favored, but it also seems as if some of it is that was a story that was sort of building. Once you got rid of Price, that was the end of it, and then you moved on to something else.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the counter argument would be, you know, these stories of sexual misconduct by powerful men. I mean, we've never seen impact like this, right? And we've never seen a story have legs. Well, I don't want to say never. I'm sure we have. But it's rare to see impact like this, and it's rare to see a story have legs like this. And so in some ways... Right. Maybe that's the difference. I don't know. I mean, you know, sort of figuring out impact is impossible to do. I mean, in L.A., I covered the sheriff of L.A. County, and, you know, he would just be reelected time and time again, sometimes not even have a challenger, you know, was sort of thought of as sheriff for life. And, you know, we did tons of critical stories that, you know, exposed abuses. And for the first, like, 3 or 4 years, it felt like, you know, it's important that we're doing these stories, but it'll never impact anything. And then before you knew it, he resigned. So it just sort of, you can never kind of predict impact. Things sort of feel like they can never happen until they do. I feel like it's a hard thing to predict.
You mentioned the sheriff, so we have to go back to it. Just changing, you got called on to testify for that sheriff story. What's that like? You obviously had a First Amendment lawyer trying to get you off. I'm assuming California doesn't have a shield, so you had to end up testifying. What was that like?
So that was a difficult position to be in. I had covered this sheriff for years, and, a reporter never wants to be part of the story and certainly never wants to be subpoenaed to testify. So initially it looked like they were trying to get me to talk about things that I hadn't reported already, which, you know, we totally were going to refuse to do, you know, no matter what the consequences were. They were never asking for sources, so it never even got to that point. But we didn't even want to talk about anything that wasn't already in a news story or a public interview that I had done. We had good lawyers, and it was still a very uncomfortable process because my fear was that, a source would be sort of background, a potential source would be backgrounding me and would see, this is someone who didn't fight off a subpoena and agreed to testify. I can't trust him anymore. So we tried to, you know, make it as clear as possible that we were just going in there and saying, you know, they were saying, was it true that, you know, this X thing you reported, was that true? Yes. You know, this other thing that you reported, was it true? Yes. I wasn't revealing any new information. But it's still something that we fought as hard as we could, because it's, it, you know, because it can have that sort of chilling effect on the work we do when the government forces us to either be part of the story or to you know, testify in a criminal case. It's not something that you want to see happen. And obviously, if it ever related to unpublished materials or revealing sources, we would never cooperate.
I was going to say, if they did try to push you, like, how far would you go? Would you, like, risk being in, like, contempt of court? And
totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Without it. I mean, because, and what I always tell sources is it's not just, we don't just do that because it's the right thing to do, but we do it because it's the self-interested thing to do. Because if we didn't, you know, if we ever revealed a source even just once, you know, that tarnishes your organization, it ends your own career, you know, you can't expect to get sources like that to trust you in the future. So that usually puts people at ease when they know they don't have to just depend on you being, you know, a stand-up person. They can also depend on you being a selfish person. Because it you know, it really is a self-interested motivation, too. You know, you want to maintain your own credibility.
Speaking of your sources, one of the things that people on the right, some of them in the administration, some not, have said or have argued is that within government, there's the deep state or people who are fighting the current administration and the current agenda. And since part of what you're doing is talking to people, I assume, especially when you're doing this story about the regulatory commissions, who are people who have been working for government for a long time, who have been there in previous administrations. I mean, do you have a sense of that, that there is some force within the established agencies that are either hostile to the current administration, hostile to its agenda?
Again, it's sort of hard to know without doing kind of a thorough, exhaustive comparison of two administrations and a scientific study that, that said, yeah, you certainly encounter people who are in these agencies and are not a fan of the current administration, and that might be a motivating factor. But I mean, a lot of these career folks are just trying to go in and do their jobs and do their jobs with integrity and do it well.
They don't have some globalist agenda, as far as you can tell.
No. I mean, the motivations for people who end up being sources will typically range from, you know, on one end, just, you know, seeing something that's wrong and wanting to expose it to, you know, sometimes it can be a little bit more self-interested. They, you know, they are trying to advance themselves at the expense of someone else. And sometimes it can just be totally bizarre and petty, like someone in the office got some perk that they didn't and they just want to blow everything up now. you know, but most of the time it's the former, that they care about the organization that they work for. They you know, they care about the truth coming out, and they're willing to take a risk to help the truth come out. But, you know, anyone who told you that the motivations of sources was always totally pure would be lying. I mean, there are instances where people have self-interested motivations.
Before we open up, the tax bill went through the House today. As Professor Leff sent me a link that some of the demands of the more higher paid donors, the Koch brothers, etc., have made their way into the tax bill. How much of an influence, just because you cover money and politics, do they have on kind of the legislation going out?
Who has?
The Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, etc., all the big donors.
You know, a ton of influence. You know, but that's true on the left and the right. I mean, you know, it's a fact about the way government works on the federal level, on the state level, on the local level, that donors get a lot of access, and when you get access, you're heard. That's not to say, though, that, you know, every decision that every politician makes is influenced by a donation, or that getting a donation, you know, and then seeing an action happen implies that that action happened because of the donation. You know, a lot of what you're seeing on tax reform or on healthcare repeal, it's also ideologically motivated. You know, it's a belief in smaller government or in reducing the tax burden on citizens. So, you know, but yeah, I mean, donors have a lot of influence, especially big donors like the Kochs or Sheldon Adelson.
That's not any less because Trump, you know, ran his campaign on self-funding. I'm not bought by anyone. I know that was the House version of the bill, but what about on Trump? Have they had an influence on him, even though he kind of has said he's self-funded, he doesn't take, you know, not beholden to anyone, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, you know, donors are still getting lots of access. You're still seeing former lobbyists work in this administration. You know, I don't think anyone on the left or the right would argue that the swamp has been entirely drained. You know, Washington still works the way Washington works.
Well, but again, before we open it up, but there's a new HHS nominee. I assume, especially given his connection to the pharmaceutical industry, that might be something you're going to be looking into. What happens? What do you do now? So there's a new nominee. He has, at least on paper, has a connection to the pharmaceutical industry. How do you go about? Is that something you are going to be taking a look at, and how do you go about it?
I'm not currently looking at that. But are you just asking in general? You know.
And why not? Just because you have things going on.
Yeah, I have my hands full with other things. I mean, maybe at some point in the future, we haven't ruled it out, but I'm not currently looking at them.
So then let's move it to the more general.
How do you typically?
Yeah, so even when Price was nominated, what did, and that, the reporting is already out there, so that might be easier to talk about. What did you, where'd you start? What'd you look at? How much of it is, I know you talked about making FOIA requests in public record, how much of that is what you do?
So, I mean, I every time you have finished one story and don't have another story yet, you feel like you're never going to ever find a story again, and that's, like, the hardest part of being a reporter, that interim period, and it happens every time. You think, I'm never going to find the story again. And I actually, an exercise I did recently is I listed out all the stories I'd ever done that I thought were, significant. I sort of, like, plotted out how it was that I first got the initial tip or the thing that made it a story. And then I tried to kind of classify in groups what those were and try to figure out, like, the magic bullet for finding significant stories. And there's no magic bullet. Sort of, like, different every time, which is maddening.
What are some of the categories?
So the categories are like filing FOIAs, getting a tip from one of these sort of like activist organizations that will go in and like try to get documents or recordings, or to talk to people on the Hill, congressional aides who would be knowledgeable, or to reach out to mid-level people in the agencies, or another category would be to reach out to people who had recently resigned and left, so knew a lot, but didn't feel like they had to be, as careful about what they said to a reporter. What are the other categories? Looking at lawsuits can be a category. It sort of depends on what you're covering at the time, what the categories are. But it just ended up sort of being like a million categories and like not much guidance. But I think the trick is just to be really proactive and to be, sure you want to file a lot of public records requests and you want to be smart about them and you want to do them in a targeted way and an informed way. You don't want to just say, hey, give me all of Tom Price's emails or, but I think almost always the best stories come from human sources. So you want to go to lunch with people as much as you can. You want to go to drinks with them. You want to be calling people. You want to actually be talking to people and developing relationships, because those conversations will almost always sort of lead to, especially if you're not just doing investigative work, if you're just looking for any kind of story, it's really rare to end an in-person conversation and not have any good ideas. And oftentimes, reporters will just sort of like stay at their desks and, just file public records requests or, you got to actually talk to people.
Does it hurt that you're in New York and the story's at least partially in Washington?
I would say it's certainly a disadvantage, right? It's best when you can just sort of casually on the fly go and see someone. But, we have a travel budget. I can go to D.C. pretty frequently. And you know, considering you know, President Trump came from New York, I mean, some of the best work on him has been done by reporters who either came from New York or are based in New York now. I mean, Maggie Haberman is still based in New York, you know, makes frequent trips out to D.C. But no, I mean, but
I didn't realize she was based
in New York. Yeah, still is based in New York. But when you're trying to sort of cover these agencies, I mean, it would be much easier to be in D.C.
You talked earlier about the torrent of information that's coming out on a almost hourly, minute-by-minute basis from this administration, both self-generated and generated by the news media. And what you suggested was this torrent prevents the press from following up on some of these stories or digging in deeper. You get a good story, and then it disappears, and you go on to something else. And I think we all assume that this is a calculated approach by the Trump administration to, like, you know, just juggling lots of balls and, you know, we can't pay much attention. Is there anything that you can suggest that the media could do to, like, stay focused on some of the things that we need to stay focused on?
What do you think we need to stay focused on that? I guess I wouldn't say. I mean, your premise was that we, you know, reporters will stop following the good stories. I think it's more. I think that they are continuing to follow the good stories. It's just that the public's attention might go to the next story. But reporters, I think, are continuing to dig into, you know, good stuff that they've found, and they're trying to expose more and reveal more. But it's just that, the attention span has shortened by a lot because there's just so much coming out. And I don't think there's any way to really change that. You know, I don't really blame news consumers for caring more about the more recent story that came out than the less recent one. That's just sort of logical. And I don't know. We just live in a time where there's lots of news. I don't know. I don't have a good answer.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I mean, it seemed like as if you guys were almost attributing that to different things, where I guess I wanted to clarify, like, do you feel like that nature of reporting and nature of focus from the public, is that more a result of, like, a calculating effort from the president or from the White House to, like, steer the narrative, or is it more a result of a population that has shortening attention span and it's very much driven by social media and has less patience and less wingspan in terms of how long stories are going to, like, be relevant for?
I mean, I think that this is just sort of like a micro answer, but I mean, social media has been amazing in a lot of ways, but I do think that one really bad thing about it is that sort of like a level-headed tweet with context will not get as many retweets and likes as a tweet that's like, oh my God, this thing is horrendous and has never been seen before. And I think that a lot of people on Twitter, reporters included, may just sort of, whether on purpose or not, sort of do more of the latter because they get more of a reward, and it's easier for the public to maybe, when everything is an outrage and when everything is unprecedented, you know, nothing is an outrage and nothing is unprecedented. And I don't think, you know, I hope that over time, you know, reporters' relationship with Twitter changes, and that's not the approach, but I think it has been the approach, and I think that's part of the problem.
I read a story recently about some journalists at ProPublica who were victims of, like, email bombings and, like, Twitter trolling. And I don't imagine any of these agencies will start trolling you, but, like, because of what you described in the way that they sort of sent around your stories, I just wondered if that was anything you ever worried about, or having your contact details in the public, is that a concern?
I mean, I put my contact information out in the public. You know, I put my Signal number on my Twitter page, and that's also my cell phone number. maybe at some point I'll regret that decision, but I just feel like when you try to reach a, you know, like if you're trying to find a reporter's contact information and you have a hard time, like that's awful. You know, like, because, you know, like you should make it really easy for people to give you tips. You know, like it should be just totally easy, like not a challenge at all, you know. So that's the approach I've used. I mean, you do get people reaching out to you that, you know, are not helpful, and then you just, you know, and if they're being purposely not helpful, you know, if they're trolling or whatever, like you just block them.
Does that happen to you?
Yeah. And you know, or they just, you know, they won't seem totally stable, and you know, that's
really real. Like, what are they saying to you on the phone?
Oh, I don't. You know, just sort of ridiculous stuff. And so then you just block them or whatever. But I feel like that's an okay cost to just make yourself readily available to people who have important tips. As far as government agencies engaging in that kind of thing, I don't see that happening. You know, like I hope that things don't get that unprofessional. I haven't seen that.
Mine's more of a basic question, I guess. A lot of the reporters we've had in here seem to, at least in part, enjoy the not knowing what they're going to be reporting on that day, even if it might be, they might see a downside to it, but it seems like a few of them at least enjoyed kind of being surprised. You obviously don't have that experience as much. Do you find yourself wishing you could get involved with that, or bored with doing the same thing every day? Bored's probably not the right word, but.
So I would put it, I'd put it a little differently. So, you know, like being in a traditional newsroom, there is sort of the energy of putting out a daily publication and, you know, the need to be comprehensive. So you're covering everything, and that just necessarily is kind of crazier and day-to-day more exciting. But, I mean, there have been a million times where my reporting will lead me in a direction, you know, my reporting at ProPublica will lead me in a direction that I sort of never imagined and will be incredibly exciting. I won't say where, just to be discreet, but there was one day where I went to work, you know, walked my dog, went to work, and before I knew it, I had to fly to a different state and had to figure out who was going to take care of my dog. Like, there's no time to, you know, do anything. So even in investigative reporting, it can be, maybe the moments of excitement are, you know, fewer and far between, but when they do come, they're just sort of like incredible, incredible highs. Like when you, the best moment ever is like when you're like, you know, like when you've gone to a source's house and you're leaving with like, you know, you're driving back in your car with like a folder of documents or a box of documents, and like, there's just like nothing ever more exciting than that moment. You know, like it's the best moment. Like I said, the worst moment is when you finish the story and think you'll never find the story again. Like the best moment is like when you get that stuff and you're like driving.
Can you give
like,
an example of that?
No, because then it would be clear. You know, like
who gave you it?
Yeah. I wouldn't want to get detailed, but like, you know, like the music is on loud. Like you're just like yelping and like, you know, like the windows are down and it's like, you know, like it's the most, it's just the best moment ever. Like there's no better moment. But that doesn't happen every day.
Right.
Not even close. You know, like you'd probably get a heart attack if it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I would say like, you know, being a beat reporter or a breaking news reporter is like maybe day to day more exciting. Like, but you know, like I think the highs of being an investigative reporter are probably. So initially I decided to like be a reporter because I kind of like fancied myself as like a writer, like a good writer. And this was like a way to, you know, like get paid and like make a living. Eventually I just sort of like started doing that kind of work and really enjoyed it. And now I just consider myself like a fact finder. And I think like I am skilled at like, writing those facts clearly and sort of like entertainingly. But I, you know, I don't really consider it like a writerly job anymore. But yeah, I just really enjoy sort of finding things out that aren't already known.
So I wanted you to talk about this anyway, and this is a good opening. But was your first, was it doing the story at UCLA? Was that your first investigative story, and how did that happen and transpire?
Yeah, so my first investigative story was in college, and I had been applying for like 200 internships every year, and getting rejected from like 200 internships every year, which was awful. And then my my senior year, you know, that had also happened the year, you know, between my junior and senior year. But then, you know, the summer of my senior year, like, I got an email tip from like someone in the dentistry school in my university at UCLA, and you know, basically what he was telling me is that the orthodontics graduate division, which like only accepts like 5 people a year, it's like this really small program, and like if you become an orthodontist, you're like made, you know, like you make a ton of money, you work like 2 days a week, and so anyway, so he told me that they were saving one spot out of like 5 or 6 every year for the relative of a donor, a major donor. And it's a public university, so it's definitely not supposed to happen. So anyway, so I started developing, you know, dentist sources across the university, you know, which was really fun. Like, some of them really got into it. Like, there was literally a parking lot meeting once, you know, like.
This probably doesn't happen a lot to dentists.
No, no, no. I was, like, filing public records requests, which, like, you know, like, I was a college journalist. Like, one of the school administrators... you know, I sent him a public records request, and he sent me one back trying to figure out who my sources were. And, like, luckily we were an independent paper, so we just ignored it. It was ludicrous. But, yeah, I mean, I was this, like, you know, I was, like, 21, and it was totally ridiculous, and I had no idea what I was doing. But, you know, it was really exciting to, like, find this thing that was a real problem and a real violation of what a public university is supposed to be doing, and to put the story out there and, like, you know, to have everything that came after that happen. You know, so yeah, I think that's what sort of got me hooked on it. I got an internship after that, finally. I don't think I ever would have without that, so thank God for corrupt dentists.
Yeah. And how did you know you had it? I mean, especially as your first story, how did you know that you had done enough work, talked to enough people that you could write confidently this one position was...
Oh, there's an email, you know, there were emails that showed it. Like, there was one email where someone was like, oh, I told so-and-so not to tell anyone his board scores. You know, the son of so-and-so, the father being a big-time donor, like, you know, I'm the one who, like, we let him in on my call. There was another email where someone was saying, like, you know, like, if you want to keep doing it the UC way, you know, the University of California, the public school way, like, we're going to have no money for anything. You know, like, people had told me, both on the record and off the record, that the head of the orthodontics program had told them that he was doing this. You know, it was, if I could go back, I'd write it differently. You know, like, I cringe when I look at it now. But,
because.
It was poorly written. I feel like the lead was, like, too wordy. I mean, at times I think that, like, we're a bit bolder in the statements. We should have been more understated. I don't know. What else?
See, now, my college paper, all we did was find out that the head of the cafeteria was taking home cans of lasagna. So that was, like, our big thing. So this is pretty impressive.
Yeah, no, it was... It was a really cool experience. Yeah. Anyway, so I got sort of hooked on it. Did anyone yell at me? Probably. I don't remember. It was a while ago. Yeah.
I kind of want to ask what she asked, but in a more general sense, like, at what point when you're doing this investigative journalism, like, at what point do you know the story is done? Are you ready to publish it? Because it's such a long, ongoing process. Like, at what point is it like, okay, I'm ready to do something?
So probably weeks or months before my editor thinks. but that's good, right? Because it's like, I would say that, like, 80% of what you get in the first, like, 30% of reporting, but then the 20% that sort of puts it over the top or makes it totally bulletproof, you get in the rest of the time. And like, that's why it's important to have good editing and editors who sort of challenge assumptions that you've made, which is really important, right? Because we all sort of like make assumptions without realizing it.
So they'll push back on you.
Yeah, and that's what they should do. And we're all doing that to ourselves too, but you know, like, you want your story to be a story. And you know, you try to push back on yourself as much as you can, but you need someone else who is outside of it and is pushing back on you. And almost always, you know, like, good editors will find holes, and you know, you'll have to address those holes, or you'll realize your story is not a story, which is important too. Like, you want to do that.
Is that hard to think you have something and then figure out that it's not going to really turn into anything?
Yeah. I would say that most of the time, though, you won't spend like weeks or months on something, and then that happens. Like, usually, you'll find out that it's absolutely not worth publishing at all, that there's nothing there, you know, pretty quickly.
I was actually going to ask a similar question to that. Has there been a time recently where there was a story that you realized, like, super quickly that it wasn't actually a story?
Huh.
What was that?
I think I suppressed those memories. There was one time, I probably remember this time because we were, you know, I mean, it happens, you know, we were close to publishing. This was at another job. But we thought that, maybe, like, can we not put this one online?
No.
That's okay. We thought that, so the share...
This is off the record.
I just don't want it online. So, you know, we had done a story about the sheriff's department that I was covering in L.A. They had an inmate was secretly working as an FBI informant, and then they found out and they hid him from the FBI. Like, they gave him a fake name. They were moving him around, you know, around the various facilities. So anyway, we thought we had found another example of that based on some emails we saw. And literally probably like 4 hours before publishing, we realized that the dates didn't work. Like, the emails that implied that they were hiding someone happened after a tour that a judge was giving. And I just had the, you know, the chronology didn't hit me until an editor caught it. And, you know, it's incredibly embarrassing, especially since we were like close to publishing, but like, it was caught before we published, and that's what editing is for. And, you know, that was not a good day. It would have been a much worse day if we caught it after we published. But yeah, so that's an example that sticks out. Got recently a ProPublica. I can't think of an example, but it happens. Yeah.
Seeing a lot of what's going on in the government, and also the coverage that's coming on during this administration and how they're covering certain angles and stories. Is there anything you think that the mainstream media is missing in terms of when they look at the government and the various administrative agencies? Is there something that you see maybe from your just background knowledge or stuff that you've seen? Do you think there's anything they're missing?
So two parts to that. A, you know, when people are like, oh, like, stop covering Russia, start covering, you know, like, policy. I mean, I think that the media in general is doing a good job of doing both. That's not to, like, I've had stories bumped or not get as good of play because a Russia story was running that day. But I think both sort of lines of inquiry are really important, and I think that, you know, doing one is not at the cost of another. You know, like, one reporter can do both, and, you know, they're... are also some reporters that are doing one and other reporters who are doing another, and that's fine.
Yeah.
That said, I feel like in general, like, the less sort of sexy agencies are undercovered. Like, EPA is covered really well. DOJ is covered really well, right? But some parts of DOJ aren't covered really well, right? So, you know, like, an example is, you know, the Washington Post recently did a series that showed that people were leaving the DEA and going to the opioid makers. And were helping, you know, these companies fight off DEA efforts because they had an intimate knowledge of the way the DEA works. And incredible story, but, like, you know, someone should have done it even sooner, right? And there's probably something similar happening at, you know, ATF or the Bureau of Prisons or one of these divisions in DOJ that, you know, is just sort of, like, less exciting. You know, like, within the federal government, like, you know, who gets super excited about USDA or, you know, MSHA, the mining safety division of Department of Labor. You know, there are all these hugely important agencies or divisions within agencies that go, you know, they're almost entirely covered by the trade press and aren't touched by the larger outlets. But I don't think that's unique to the Trump administration.
Yeah, right. I mean, do you read the trade press? Is that ever a place where you would get story ideas?
Yeah, but, you know, they're doing like a million stories a day. And so there's, you know, they do good work, and they're probably better sourced than a lot of reporters and mainstream outlets. But they just have a different audience, right? They're writing for the industry, and they're also just doing, you know, five stories a day. So, you know, they won't do that kind of work just because I feel like there's not as much of an interest among their readership, and there's not you know, enough resources and time given to them by their outlets.
But even getting back to the question of, I mean, one of the things that I think has been said probably correctly is that, well, there hasn't been many legislative achievements on the part of the Trump administration, although perhaps that's about to change, that there's been a big change in the regulatory and within the agencies, and the EPA is usually the example that's offered. Is that happening in other agencies and we're just not paying attention, we're not seeing it? I mean, do you have a sense that there's a lot going on in housing and urban development, for example, or is the focus on the EPA sensible because that's where all the changes are happening?
I mean, the EPA is hugely important, and I think that it should get a lot of attention, and, you know, I think it makes sense to focus on the EPA because the head of the EPA, you know, Pruitt, has been one of the more sort of productive, knowledgeable, you know, sort of efficient agency heads. You know, he came in with a lot of knowledge of, you know, he had been fighting these Obama-era regulations already, you know, in his previous post. And so he has been very quick and very productive. In other agencies, what you're seeing is sort of incompetence or neglect. So one of my colleagues at ProPublica did a pretty, you know, went really deep at HUD and, you know, Ben Carson. And, you know, a lot of what was happening there is just sort of neglect. And so that's a different kind of problem to expose, but also important. And, I mean, you'll see that in an agency where the agency head has no prior experience with, you know, the issues that their agency is responsible for. So which one is more important? I mean, which one's probably more impactful? Probably someone who's proactive and knowledgeable like Pruitt. But, you know, you're seeing major consequences in agencies where that's not the case as well.
But your sense is overall you think the press is doing a good job of covering what's happening at the cabinet level, at the agency level, and not just focusing on the White House and Twitter and whatever else is happening.
No, I would say that, you know, if there were more resources thrown at these agencies, that would be a good thing. It's hard to know. I mean, it's not like there are too many reporters at the White House, though. You know, that's important too. I don't know how you make that call and how you make that calculation. I mean, you know, I'm sure the head of every newsroom would tell you they'd hire a ton more reporters if they could, but they can't. So, you know, I don't know what the calculation is there.
One question while they think. One question I had in the beginning, I forgot to get to it. Does ProPublica and their founders kind of, I know you know, they strive, you guys strive on bipartisan, what, you know, what's the story
nonpartisan.
Is there, nonpartisan.
Yeah.
Does their kind of financial history and who they've donated to, does that ever burden you guys at all?
Yes and no. So the yes is that, you know, I've been sort of attacked on the right as like a Soros-funded reporter. Prior to being attacked as a Soros-funded reporter, I can tell you honestly, I didn't even know we had gotten any money from a group connected to him. But it's true that, you know, some of our donors also have political agendas. The no is really important. The no is that there is a clear separation between our funders and our fundraising operation and our reporting. You know, we never let donors have any say over our coverage. There have been times where our, you know, coverage has been damaging for the interests of our donors, and that's irrelevant. Anytime a donor will, I mean, you know, I'm not in these conversations on purpose, right? Because, you know, reporters are completely separated from this. But I know that the people who lead our organization, you know, do not allow donors to have any say in coverage. You know, donors can't even fund a particular story or specific topic. They can only get sort of broad, like they'll give a grant for environment reporting or healthcare reporting or regulatory reporting. I mean, they're not even allowed to get more specific than that. You know, but does it leave us open for criticism at times? You know, sure, but there's a clear separation in it. I've never, ever been told, you know, so-and-so's a donor, go easy on them. The same way when I was at, you know, a for-profit newspaper, I was never told, you know, so-and-so is an advertiser, go easy on them. It's, you know, it's just never happened.
What has been your favorite story
So this maybe wasn't like the biggest topic, but when I was at the LA Times, I covered, I came across this memo that basically laid out that like this star rookie cop, he had just come out of the academy and like his first job was in the jails, and we'd been doing stories about jail abuse, and he like was 6 weeks on the job, you know, graduated at the top of his class, like literally at the top of his class. And suddenly resigns, you know, like had an uncle who was in the department, you know, that came from a law enforcement family. It didn't make sense, like, why he just sort of cited family reasons. But what we learned was that the real reason was that his supervisor had made him beat up a mentally disabled inmate and then cover it up. And so, you know, like, reporting that story out was really satisfying, A, because it was just an important story to get out, but B, because it sort of like showed, it certainly showed what bad law enforcement looks like and the damage that can have, but it also sort of showed what, you know, like law enforcement with a lot of integrity could have, right? Like this guy, all he wanted to do was to be a cop, to be a good cop, and was forced into a situation where he couldn't be a good cop and, you know, decided he couldn't deal with that and left. And he was like working in an oil field in Colorado, like left everything. He, you know, like he wouldn't even cooperate with my story, which was really interesting. You know, like he was still sort of like being a good soldier, which like, you know, like in my opinion, the most moral thing to do would be to sort of like, you know, open up and be truthful and tell all the details, but he had sort of like a different set of values, which was like, you know, like you do the right thing, but you don't sort of like make fellow law enforcement officers look bad, which I thought was interesting. So his no comment to me was, you know, like a wise man cries more often than he speaks. And he's like this big, burly, tattooed law enforcement guy, but you just imagine him like, you know, like he did the right thing, and like, you know, like he was still sort of dealing with the emotional toll of that. And like, you know, he graduated at the top of his class, totally honest, you know, like he like was at the top of the physical test, everything. Like, this is someone you want to be a cop in your community. And, you know, circumstances where people were, you know, violating policy and the law forced him out, which is like just a terrible thing for the, you know, for the community. I think everyone would agree. And, you know, his boss was then investigated by the FBI and indicted, and, you know, I don't know if he started his sentence yet, but it was sentenced, and, you know, another person who was part of that. You know, so that was a, you know, it was satisfying to get that guy's story out there.
Did you get onto it just by, it was sort of like, why did this guy leave? I need to find this out, or did you?
No, so the way that happened was, it's sort of, I guess this is a lesson in why, like, it's important to know, like, what records are public and whatever agency you're covering, but we had learned that when the DA decides not to charge a cop with a crime, when there's an investigation but they decide not to charge, they have to write a detailed memo out, and that memo was, like, available for, like, a two-month span after it was written. But you have to go to the DA's office and, like, ask for it and look through it, so we would just do that on a routine basis. And the reason that this showed up in that was because when he went into the jailhouse and resigned that day, his uncle, who I, you know, mentioned was a veteran detective, like, caught wind of it and knew the real reason. And he showed up at the jailhouse and, like, made his boss, you know, come outside and, like, you know, like, threatened to kill him. you know, was really upset that you know, this guy had done this to his nephew who was just starting out on the job. And so then the boss, you know, he probably regrets this now, the boss reported that guy for the death threat. And so that resulted in an investigation and a memo. And, like, you know, that let us know about, you know, that gave us the, you know, the tip that this had happened. But, you know, anyway, what was my point? Oh, yeah, so that's, right. So that was a good one, you know, and I, you know, I think about that one.
So just the flip side of that, a story you regret.
Story I regret. story I regret. I don't think I regret any stories. I mean, you know, like, there but for the grace of God, but I've never had any sort of major corrections or instances where I realized that, you know, something was framed in an unfair way. No, I don't think I'm sure it'll happen. You know, I hope not. We try our best.
You think that's because you have more time to write? I mean, you know, most reporters, they have to get 3-4 stories out a day or a week or whatever.
Yeah, that certainly helps.
Yeah.
You know, like, when you have to go quickly, you inevitably have a higher risk of getting something wrong.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, guys.